It's number 0830567. We'll call Mr. Stroud to begin with.
Good morning. This, first of all, I want to start off and advise the court that the third issue I raised about the restitution after reading the government's brief and looking back at the court's order, I would agree that the court ordered restitution as part of the condition of supervised release, so I don't want to waste anybody's time, and I concede that the government's correct on that issue. With respect to the other two issues,
that's very generous of you. We really appreciate it.
The sufficiency of evidence argument on counts 2, 3, and 6 focuses upon the intent and knowledge aspects of these charges. As I'm sure the court is aware, this was a 6-count indictment. My client, Mr. Thomas, was charged in a conspiracy along with Lewis Bradley. Both were found not guilty on that count. Mr. Bradley was found not guilty on all counts, but Mr. Thomas was found guilty on counts 2 and 3, the false statement counts, and count 6, the evasion count. Mr. Thomas was a country lawyer whose lifelong dream was to practice law, and he got in trouble, and back in 1994, I'm sure the court's aware of that, he pled guilty to 2 counts of failing to file a return, misdemeanor counts. He was sentenced to a year in prison, and on the bar side of the house, he was suspended from the practice of law for 9 months. He served his term of imprisonment before the suspension began. And he was suspended from, and I think it's the key to this point, one of the keys of the case, he was suspended from November 23rd, 1997 to August of 1998. Because of his problems, Lewis Bradley was retained to help Mr. Thomas. As Mr. Thomas testified at trial, his books were a mess, a total mess. The third player in this case was an administrative assistant to Mr. Thomas, Maitre Hamilton. Unfortunately, Ms. Hamilton died before trial and was not available to testify. With respect to counts 2 and 3, the false return counts, I would point to page 34 of the government's brief, where they concede that Bradley received all of Mr. Thomas's bank records, which included every deposit as well as every expenditure made by the firm. The government then argues that Mr. Thomas had an additional duty to provide follow-up information to the accountant. I agree that that's a duty on the part of the taxpayer when questioned by the CPA. Under the evidence at this case, Mr. Bradley never called and never asked Mr. Thomas the first thing after everything was sent in.
So what you're saying is that Thomas did not inform Bradley about this Wiley case, that they were negotiating towards that. Is that what you're saying? Is that what the government said?
And I believe that's right, Your Honor. There was no, particularly with respect to the Wiley case, there was no communication between Mr. Thomas and Mr. Bradley. However, I go back to the fact that all that money, though, was accounted for. It may have been accounted for improperly because of the work of the CPA, but Mr. Thomas didn't hide this money. He didn't keep a double set of books. He didn't move monies back and forth. I think what you had here, unfortunately, was a taxpayer who didn't keep up with his business properly, and a CPA whose defense, quite frankly, at trial, and I'm not trying to disparage anybody, but his expert basically said this man's incompetent, that he took...
Bradley's defense was that he was incompetent?
No, Bradley's defense is that regardless of how you label Mr. Thomas, he felt that he provided all information to his account and that that's all he had to do, and he never received any information back. And I get to this mysterious year-ending journal entries. There were 6 of them made by Mr. Bradley. And quite frankly, nobody could figure out why that was done. In fact, his expert said it shouldn't have been done like that. It was wrong, and he should have better documented his file. Now, Mr. Thomas indicated that he knew that there was an additional taxes owed, and when he had a meeting several years later with Mr. Pritchard, he said, well, tell us what we owe and we'll pay it. But this goes back, and I think the government's position is that on the sufficiency of evidence, that there was enough evidence from which to infer a specific intent to violate a specific intent to violate a known legal duty. And in tax cases, as I'm sure this court is aware, that's the standard used. It's the Cheek standard. My two arguments basically blend together: the deliberate ignorance instruction and the sufficiency of evidence instruction. I simply, if you take the case and look at it, and I'm aware of the standard, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, was there sufficient evidence for a reasonably minded jury to find each element proven by beyond a reasonable doubt? And when you look at this case and the history of Mr. Thomas and his relationship with Mr. Bradley, you had several things going on. You had this whole business of the offering compromise, which began on November the 23rd, 1997. In essence, this OIC is the basis for count six, the evasion charge. The government says that Mr. Bradley, on November the 23rd, 1997, should have disclosed that he was he anticipated an income in the Wiley case. The Wiley case was a case in Mississippi. At that time, severe question about liability. The case involved a car that ran a stop sign and hit a 18-wheeler, and there was serious injuries. And I also would point out to the court, on this date, November 23rd, 1997, Mr. Thomas was beginning his period of suspension. The government says that on question 19, anticipated income, when the no was checked, that was a false statement because Mr. Bradley should have anticipated receiving a fee in the Wiley case. I'm not a plaintiff's lawyer. I do defense work, civil work. When we send bills out and we have accounts receivable, and if I were filling the form out, I would probably, do you anticipate any income? I would list my accounts receivable. But as I understand, plaintiff's attorneys work on a contingency fee basis. And on November the 23rd, 1997, Mr. Thomas did not have an accounts receivable. He had begun negotiations in the case. When he came off of suspension in November, in August of 1998, he got involved in the case again. On January the 1st, 1999, he had a heart attack, and the case was settled in April of 1998, the same month that the OIC was accepted by the IRS. I think an important exhibit in this case is, I believe, our exhibit, a record excerpt 7. The 433A, the collection information statement for individuals. This was the document that flowed with the package from beginning to end. This was a statement of Mr. Thomas's income on page, or anticipated income. On page 19, and the problem the government has is on the second page it says, other information relating to your financial condition. If you check the box yes, please give dates and explain on page 4. On E, anticipated increase in income, there's a no check, or X. And I believe on November the 23rd, 1997, in Mr. Thomas's mind, that was a correct answer. Complicating the matter is, if you turn to the last page, this form was signed by Lewis Bradley. Lewis Bradley was the accountant for Mr. Thomas. Now, there was argument about whether or not he had the authority to sign this document. The trial court overruled my objection, but I still urge it to this court. Another problem you have is that there are changes to the document, and all these changes were made by Mr. Bradley and Mr. Pritchard. And when you see that updated first date 4898, updated 9-23-98. All that was done with Mr. Bradley and Mr. Pritchard. At the time, apparently, the testimony was the taxpayer, according to IRS regulation, didn't have to sign the form. It could be signed by his POA. But subsequently, and I put that regulation in as Exhibit 6, that the IRS policy now is that since collection information statements require certification under penalty of perjury, the taxpayer must personally sign the form 433A and or 433B. It was my argument at trial, and it's my argument to this court, that there's something fundamentally wrong about being charged with perjury for an act done by the agent when you don't know what the agent's doing.
Let me just ask you, the government has a timeline at the back of its brief.
Yes, ma'am.
And what seemed particularly critical to me are two dates toward the end of it. One of them is March 31 of 99. There's a check for over $5 million payable to Sam Thomas. And the second one is April 27 of 99, letters from IRS informing Thomas of acceptance of OIC. And then the latest addendum is filed February 25 of 1999. So if the point of what the IRS was trying to do was ascertain his, economic status at the time they were determining whether to accept a substantial discount, then the jury could draw the inference, couldn't they, that he was not being candid with them?
Yes, ma'am, I think that's one way, and that's certainly one way to look at it. My problem, again, is that this entire process, though, had taken place. The OIC, 90% of it had taken place between Mr. Bradley and the IRS. And I didn't see anywhere in here, and I'm not trying to make light of it, but I do think it's an issue. There was no indication or suggestion that if something else happens, you have to report it to us. Now, maybe that's the way you should do, but I think in Mr. Thomas's mind, the two things were separate. And he was out there, again, he was not hiding anything. He reported everything to his CPA, and the returns were filed. There was no money hidden under the bed, so to speak.
But isn't there evidence in the record that not only did he not report this, but he was actually trying to hide from the government that he had gotten this $500,000?
Well, that was the government's argument.
Isn't that their theory?
Yes, ma'am. That was their theory. But I think Mr. Thomas testified, and that he used CDs in his bank. He was a very unsophisticated taxpayer himself. His theory all along was, and this goes to intent, it's my money, I put it in the bank, what am I doing wrong? If Mr. Bradley had told him, you need to pay more tax, I think he'd pay more tax. Here's a guy it simply doesn't make any sense to me that a guy gets in trouble with the IRS. He hires a CPA to keep him out of trouble, which we would all do, and he gets right back in trouble again. That's what's mind-boggling to me, is that the help that he hired and working with that man caused a worse situation for him. I think he wanted to do right. This OIC to me, is problematic because he never signed a financial statement, that 433A. And I just believe it. And if you throw that out, then I think there goes count six. And the IRS, but my time's up. Thank you.
Yes, sir. You do have time for rebuttal. Ms. Tessier. Speaking of relying on one's accountant, why is it that the accountant got off when this fellow got convicted?
Well, it's only supposition, Your Honor, but the jury heard both defendants testify. Both of them had an opportunity to testify. And juries do what juries do. They determine who to believe and who not to believe, in which evidence to look at more closely. With respect to Mr. Bradley, we can go right to the heart of the issue here. Bradley testified that he did, in fact, question many of the entries. He received the statements, the bank statements, from Thomas's office with no explanation or very little explanation. He proceeded to post them because he had a program and he was on a retainer with Mr. Thomas to post them to keep the books so that he could prepare the tax returns. With respect to the purchase of the Lexus, the $53,000, Mr. Bradley was never told that the $53,000 check was for the purchase of a car or how the car was to be used or for whom it was to be used and in whose name it was to be titled.
Well, it didn't say made out to cash. It surely said made out to an auto dealership.
He was told it was a client expense when he called the office. Now, he may have been a little on the incompetent side to believe such a thing, but he was given general instructions, and he testified to this at the trial. And
was his defense that he was incompetent as a...
No, Your Honor. His defense was essentially that he worked with the material and the information that he had.
I think he was the one who was deliberately ignorant, if that's the case. I mean, that...
That may have been, Your Honor, but the jury determined that he was not guilty of conspiring with Thomas or of deliberately doing anything wrong. The record citations to this portion of Bradley's testimony begins around page 822 and continues to 839, and that portion of his testimony, for example, with respect to the CDs that were purchased, they were purchased with checks written on the corporate account, and he was told they were corporate assets. Well, that's a believable thing, except that the actual CDs were not in the name of the corporation. One of them was in the name of Thomas's wife. I believe another one was in the name of his son, and it was later cashed in with no explanation to Bradley.
Suppose he had given proper advice, then these things would have been reported, wouldn't they?
They would have been, likely, would have been recorded.
I mean, one has led to share Mr. Stroud's shock.
It is shocking, Your Honor, but this defendant, this particular defendant, is arguing sufficiency of the evidence to convict him of knowingly and willfully filing a false income tax return. And there is abundant evidence in the record to support his knowledge. First of all, he signed the returns under penalty of perjury. In the year for which his taxes were paid, he spent over $310,000 in a very short span of time in April to early June, right after he received these huge attorney's fees checks from the settlement of the Wiley case. Defendant retained the bank statements from those particular months in which the deposit was made for the Wiley attorney's fees. He retained those bank statements until approximately August of 1999 when he sent them all to Bradley. Bradley did prepare and send drafts of the income tax returns for 1999 to defendant sometime in February. Defendant did not respond to him And so Bradley requested an extension, which was his normal procedure when he doesn't have the tax return completed. He automatically files for an extension for his clients. He did that. Bradley received a call from Matra Hamilton telling him that the income on the returns was too high. This was not to Matra's benefit, but to Sam Thomas's benefit. That is when the questioned journal entries were made. The proposed income tax return that Bradley had prepared in February has an income level very close to what the government actually calculated defendant's proper income tax income level would have been. Bradley had it as $1,147,000. The government had it at $1.2 million as the amount of income for Thomas. So the journal entries that were made that substantially reduced his tax liability, both personally and corporately, those were made at the request of Matra Hamilton.
I don't understand that. I guess it follows up on Chief Judge Jones' point. Why is it that the professional is relying upon a statement that something is too high and then making these complicated journal entries that would not be a competent thing to do? And I'm trying to understand what's happening at the trial on this.
Your Honor, I don't know why. He explained the entries that were explained to him. He did it on the believing what the client told him was the proper way of handling these expenses. They were termed client expenses, many of them, that turned out not to be such, but they were. That was what he was told, and that was how he treated them. He also made some errors, one of them in the treatment of a $25,000 donation, which the corporation could not have taken, but he did put it on the corporate return, and he put it on the personal return also. He also treated a dividend incorrectly and readily acknowledged that he had treated that incorrectly. It would be, this particular CPA would not be someone that you would want to really rely on. But he was relying on someone who was deliberately hiding also. Defendant filed a financial statement with Cross Keys Bank for the purpose of getting a loan in late 1999. And he states in that financial statement that his salary and wages are $200,000. Yet his total income on personal income stated on his income tax return for that same year was $66,000. This is a case of the defendant knew well that he was making substantially more money. It does not include the $310,000 that he had spent earlier that year on personal things. Evidence of his knowledge with respect to counts 2 and 3 continues. He told Bradley to stop preparing monthly statements. Bradley was preparing for a while monthly statements showing defendant what his financial situation was. Thomas told him to stop preparing those. He didn't want to know. Bradley testified that defendant kept up with client expenses and receipts personally. Bradley testified that there is no indication on the checks what they were for, and he was repeatedly told they were for client expenses. And that is all in Bradley's testimony.
Now, was Bradley a corporate account? He was not the corporate bookkeeper, though. He was just for the tax man.
He was the tax person, but he also maintained a computer program in which he kept up with the expenses and sorted them out, expenses and income.
On an ongoing basis?
On an ongoing basis.
Well, maybe Mr. Thomas didn't want to pay for that. I mean, I realize that could be as little as a Quicken program, but when the accountant starts charging you on an hourly basis, it adds up.
I believe it was a monthly retainer, and I think it was $500 a month is what he was paid for that. And I think that I'm recalling correctly. Hmm. With respect to the evidence on count 6, the Wiley case began in January 1996. The Mississippi attorneys both testified that the settlement with Traditional Trucking was enforceable, and they had communicated this to defendant and to Charles Jones, the other attorney, Louisiana attorney on the case, as early as August of 1997. Defendant was in touch with all of these attorneys on the case and with the client. He testified except during the time he was on suspension, but I think the timeline indicates something happened in between there that he did have. No, I'm sorry, there is nothing in there.
But
it was right afterwards.
I mean, there was no settlement until late 98, right?
That is correct.
So,
right.
Right. And I don't see how anybody, how the IRS can hold anybody liable for predicting that the money's in the bag.
But defendant never even told them of the potential that the money might be there.
He completely withheld
that.
I mean, until the dates that I mentioned on your timeline, I think it's a very treacherous thing to say maybe that, you know, you can apply that to a lawsuit, you can apply that to a potential contract to distribute your goods, you can do that to a potential contract that you're going to a doctor who's going to go into a new facility where there are more patients available or something. That's a very dangerous proposition to say that's willful misleading in and of itself.
But, Your Honor, he did not even give them the opportunity to weigh that, and the IRS agent testified at trial that they would have treated it as a — they would not have given him the benefit at that point, but they would have said, well, let's carry this as a contingency for a while and see what happens. They would have considered that in their negotiation and in their determination of whether to accept his offer in compromise. It was a material factor to them, and that there is testimony at trial of that. Also, defendant continued to hide it after he received it, continued to do everything in his power to keep it from showing up on his 1999 income tax return by disguising it as client expenses and spending it personally and through Matra Hamilton's direction.
Well, those, I'm not really challenging the counts 2 and 3 in this regard. I'm talking about the evasion count.
Okay. With respect to the evasion counts, defendant did sign Form 433A and 433B, and there is testimony to that effect in Pritchard's testimony and in Pritchard's testimony in the government's case in chief, as well as in Pritchard's testimony in rebuttal. The government called him back, and he did testify to defendant's signature on those forms in which he I don't remember the specifics on those particular forms because there were ongoing negotiations on it, but he did misrepresent his potential, his earning potential at that time.
Again, I just don't see how anybody can be fault until the late period, that when the compromise, when they accepted the compromise and he already had the money in hand. It seems to me at that point, since he had a continuing duty to update, at that point or around that time, he was clearly deceiving them.
Right. He was clearly deceiving them before they accepted it. And the basis on which he was prosecuted was that he did deceive them. He did hide material information from the Internal Revenue Service. And the timeline does support that, at least from March 31st to April 23rd of 1999. The government contends that it was an ongoing deception.
But, you know, suppose they had accepted it 6 months earlier. Now, you can say, you know, and leave aside the false tax return for 99, because just leave that aside, because that's not a necessary concomitant. But if they had accepted it 6 months earlier, then all you would have had was a potential thing, you know, a potential settlement.
Well, he still had that other settlement that was enforceable, and the attorneys did say that it was. They completely shelved it. They knew they were going to go back and get it and from the first defendant, Traditional Trucking.
That wasn't as much money, though.
No, it was not as much money. It would have only landed him, I think, about $90,000. Let's see where I go from here. I would like to go to the a quote from Cheek versus United States, with respect to the deliberate ignorance instruction and defendant's belief that he was doing everything in his power and everything that was required. In Cheek versus United States, the Supreme Court said, knowledge and belief are characteristically questions for the fact finder, in this case, the jury. And that holds true here. Later in the opinion, the court says, of course, the more unreasonable the asserted beliefs or misunderstandings are, the more likely the jury will consider them to be nothing more than simple disagreement with known legal duties imposed by the tax laws, and will find that the government has carried its burden of proving knowledge. The jury rejected Thomas's claim of a good faith belief that his income was accurately stated and that he had fully complied with the tax laws and that he had fully complied with the requirements of making an offer in compromise and that he had not misrepresented his financial condition at that time. Once he is shown to have knowledge, then to file those income tax returns and to proceed on with the offer in compromise as though this knowledge did not exist demonstrates the necessary willfulness to support the jury verdict. Defendant was attempted to hide behind Matra Hamilton and behind Lewis Bradley. Maybe he picked up that Lewis Bradley was not the most competent person, but he gave Lewis Bradley very little information, and much of the information that he gave him was incomplete or inaccurate. And Bradley went forward with that information as though he had all that he needed. Are there any other questions?
No, ma'am.
The court has.
I don't think so. Thank you.
May I call the court attention to Bradley's testimony and Thomas's testimony, and then also to the district judge's ruling. He had a written ruling on the motion for judgment of acquittal, and the government also had a response to the defendant's application for judgment of acquittal, and those are in the record in the pleadings.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Stroud.
I would just like to leave the court with this. On page 34 of the government's brief, the government says, and I quote, the government concedes that Mr. Thomas gave Mr. Bradley all of his bank statements, which included every deposit as well as every expenditure made by the law firm. So this is not a case of hiding money from anyone. The OIC business, and I respectfully disagree with Ms. Cassier, Form 433A, which began this OIC process, was not signed by Mr. Thomas. It was signed by Lewis Bradley. And in fact, the agent, Mr. Pritchard, initially said on this anticipated increase in income that he put the check, and then in rebuttal it came back and he said, no, I think Mr. Bradley or somebody else may have done it. To use this form as a basis to, in effect, convict Mr. Thomas, it's a strange proposition to me. Did Mr. Thomas make errors? Yes. Did he make mistakes? Yes. When he got the money in for the settlement. Oh, and one thing before that too, on this anticipated income. And I know it's not part of the record, but I do know a few plaintiff's attorneys, and I asked them when are they in on a contingency fee basis. When do you realize the money? He said. All of them said, without exception, when it's in the bank. And on November the 23rd, 1997, nothing was in the bank. Now you go to April 1998, and the question becomes, did Mr. Thomas have a duty to tell the IRS about this supplemental income? I don't know. The safest way would have been to disclose it, but again, he was not going around in a manner to hide it from the IRS. And with respect to the deliberate indifference instruction, and I know this court, The last case is coming now, and they've upheld the instruction, but the court did say, and I cited the case in my brief, if the evidence shows that the defendant should have known, only shows that the evidence should have known, then the blind ignorance instruction is inappropriate. And I cited that in my brief. I didn't bring it back up. I think it's the Thomas case. It's at page 24 of my brief, which the court states, a court should not give a deliberate ignorance instruction when the evidence shows only that the defendant should have been aware of the illegal conduct. And that's what the government has been talking about here. And I would respectfully submit that that instruction was an error also. You've afforded me a thank you for the opportunity to express my argument. I don't have anything else. Does the court have any questions?
No, I don't think so, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.